Welcome to Tilt Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about splitting nitrogen applications. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at a potential Roundup replacement. Ag History Minute, we'll talk about the history of turkey for Thanksgiving. In our Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events. We'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilties out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. Well, 27 is the magic number. 5 out of 6 times.
27 what?
Points for
dresses?
The Green Bay Packers.
Oh, not 27 dresses.
5 of their 6 wins are... They scored exactly 27 points. Right. The only one that was more that they actually won was against the Steelers. That was 35, I think.
That is correct.
What about the Cowboys tie?
Doesn't count.
Tie doesn't count. It's not a loss, but it's not a win.
All right.
So, I don't know if you saw it. I did. I indeed saw Bill when he messaged you and I, said, they scored 27, they're going to win.
That's it. It's a weird score to score as well. Like, it's... You got to miss an extra point in general.
Or two.
Or two, yeah. And make it 2 points.
Or have 2 field goals and 3 touchdowns. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, but they've managed to do it 5 times this season so far.
It won't be magic if they score 27 and lose now, but...
Right, but so far, it's panned out.
It's magic.
This weekend... Is going to be.
I thought you were going to bring up the other 27 thing that keeps popping up.
What's that?
That Rodgers was 27 years old.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
And Love is 27 years old. And so was Favre. Favre was 27 years old. So I just think it's ironic that those both come through. Yes.
True.
Apparently,
true.
When you're 27, if you score 27, you will win.
Yes. That's the magic of 27.
Yes. 60% of the time works every time. All right, move on, man. Right. Yeah, that's
6-7.
No, absolutely please. Not.
That's thankfully dying quickly. Thankfully,
it is.
Oh, my kids. Well, it's not the regular doctor, but the doctor we've seen had a whole video on advertising for the company he works for about how they understand kids, and he had to do the whole thing in there. Just having, like, knowing the guy and the guy's personality, it made no sense. It was really funny. Watch it.
My boys about lost it when Rashawn Gary did it a couple weeks ago after a sack.
Sure.
Yep.
It does come up in agriculture too many times. That's weird. Like, I added in the depth to soil sampling, usually
6 to 7
inches. Yep. There was 2 other times, and then I was just like, this is dumb. Like,
Sunday at one point. There were 4 football games that were 6-7.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Every middle schooler was just losing it.
They were all having a ball.
Yep.
Like, ah. No, but.
pH. 6-7 pH. Oh, that's the other spot I ran into it. Like, oh, sure. What's ideal for pH? Oh, yeah, like 6 or 7. And they're like, oh, man. You know, the farmer gave me a weird look. I'm like, okay, not. That was more specific.
You didn't use your hands?
No, I didn't do the thing.
6-7.
I was like, okay, for corn we want 6.4, and alfalfa we want 6.8. So I just went more specific.
Good job.
Way to power through.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you got your rifle all sighted in, Matt?
Sure.
Todd's it might have been sighted in for years. Or never.
That's yes. When I seen it there. Never been sighted.
A dirty point buck.
Dirty point buck.
Dirty point buck. Dirty point buck.
Dirty point buck. Dirty point buck.
Well, he was 8 foot tall, weighed 12,000 pounds. With every step, there was a shaking on the ground.
So it is the opening weekend of deer season this weekend. It's late this year because Thanksgiving's late. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But, be interesting to see what kind of the weather looks actually pretty nice for this weekend from a temperature standpoint.
So what's nice, though? Like,
it's nice that you won't
nice
have to wear,
deer?
Like, nah, it's less than ideal for deer hunting probably because you don't want it to be too warm. It'd be nice to have a little bit of snow to track. but it won't be. Probably won't have to worry about getting too cold.
You're not going to get snow to track.
No, maybe rain.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, by next weekend though, Thanksgiving looks like the kind of drop off. I think it's either Thanksgiving or the Friday after Thanksgiving. The high is 29 degrees.
Ooh. So if we don't get our soil samples pulled before deer hunting.
Yep. Be good to wrap up whatever you can. Because we're going to get a warm stretch through the weekend here, and then next week it's going to start going the other way. So
it is almost December, so it's okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, as far as typical weather for this time of year, we're probably trending more up than down the way it's been going. Last night I thought it was going to be foggier again.
Yeah, those
two
foggy,
nights ago was
those,
really foggy.
Yeah.
It was bad.
It was patchy really bad, so you'd hit a patch. And
the roads were icy.
You'd be like, yeah, and the roads were icy in different spots, yeah.
Even yesterday going down, like it was down by Fond du Lac, and there was still fog at like 11 o'clock in one area down there.
We hit a spot where it was odd because we were so zen, and there was like 2 inches of snow on the ground. Near Oshkosh.
Yeah, from Nina to Oshkosh, there was
And then not very far away.
Accumulated snow.
Gone. So.
And it wasn't, it wasn't down south, and it really even wasn't that far to the west. A little bit over, like, towards Princeton. Not as much as there was in Oshkosh, but you'd get, like, patches where there was some, but mostly just frost. And the old hoar frost, where all of the trees and everything looked
were
covered
pretty,
in
icicles. Right.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Well, good. Hope you have a safe deer season, Matt, and a good one.
Well,
a successful one. And
do you go out with your dad?
Yep. Actually, my brother will be coming out this weekend, too, so it'll be three of us. And well, my son will probably come out for some of it, too. But
How is he out there? Does he stay quiet and do what he's supposed to, or does he get anxious?
He's still a little squirrely, but not too bad. He knows he's got to be quieter so he can actually see something. If he makes too much noise, then you just don't see anything other than squirrels. Lots of squirrels.
Is it the same squirrel?
Sometimes. Sometimes it's different squirrels.
How do you know? You just...
Well, if it's in the tree with you and it doesn't run away, it's the same squirrel. Just might go around the other side of the tree and come back. But, there's usually enough of them out there. Be interesting to see. The corn was not fully off the last time I was out there, so we'll see where.
So I'm assuming you want it harvested. Have more movement.
Some guys like to leave some out there. Problem is, if it's like the whole field and none of it's taken off, then they just sit in there and they don't come into the woods. So I prefer to have it harvested. But
do you drive or just sit?
I mostly sit.
Yeah, guys drive anymore? It just seems like that
infrequently. Like it's something that happens probably the second weekend where it's like, well, okay, I just need to see something or want
to
try
now.
To move something. Yeah.
It's not a safety thing that they don't anymore.
It probably is something.
This is a non-deer hunter like looking on side, but with the advent of more food plots.
Mm-hmm.
The dry, like, it's like, nope, now I got this area that I'm going
to bring them into.
Yeah, I got a garden I'm hunting over while I walk around to try to drum them up. Like, that changed it, but I don't, that's just an outsider looking in.
It's not really a common thing anymore. You still see people do it once in a while, but.
It's like if you're soil sampling that week, if they're driving. One time I was it was south, I was by Madison soil sampling, and they were driving deer, and that was not a good
decision to be in the
field. And I was just, hey, you should be good to go. And then they were nice about it at least. And then I said, okay, I'll go somewhere else. Or we kind of worked around the drive so I'd kick something up. But it was.
I said, they didn't just say, hey, can you like drive your four wheeler through here, over there, and come back? And we'll all just stand here. when the corn's been on, those are the years that we might try to drive something out of there, but in general, it's been quite a few years since we even tried to do something like that. So, All right. You guys ready to get into our topic for today?
Yeah.
So.
Bill just gave it not a let's do it. Just a yeah.
It's a go.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Ready.
Yeah. Okay. So I know we're not going to be doing any of this for a while, but just looking at, you know, we've been talking about plots and plot data and looking at different things and deciding on corn varieties and everything for next year. And part of that, we don't know where prices will be next year and might be thinking about different ways to save money if margins are still tight coming into next year. So split application nitrogen is something that a lot of guys, it's do or don't. Like either you have the capacity or you're used to doing it or you just don't. You put it all up front. And it's something where I think people sometimes assume either, oh, it's better for one reason or another. So I thought we'd take a look at that. So Minnesota, I found an article that talked about things to do when you're going to split apply, like thinking about what is your capacity to do it. Are you doing it yourself? Are you hiring someone to do it? What kind of soil are you dealing with? What kind of product are you going to be using? And those are all good considerations. And then Iowa State had actual study looking at split applied nitrogen. And I also found some research from University of Wisconsin on split applied. And so my question to you two is, do you think split applied is always the answer, sometimes the answer, or doesn't really matter?
Is there none of the above?
Well, it'd be like the doesn't matter, wouldn't it?
Yeah, right. No. What's D?
What is D?
Yeah. I think sometimes is what I would say. Yeah. It probably depends on the soils and then the weather.
Right.
But I would say, like, that is one difficult part is we think it's all the time. It's one of the four R's. It'd be the right time.
Right rate at the right time. Yep.
So, like, your time, like you say, you're splitting it, so you're changing your rate and your timing. So I think that part is, one of those splits, though, may be the wrong time. You just don't know that. So you're sort of splitting your risk out into multiple times into, say, applying it all at once. That could be the perfect time, but you don't know that always. So I'm going to go with, I believe it was C sometimes.
That is a good point, Todd, of like, it's all about, it might not be the right time, but you're spreading your risk.
Right.
To minimize the wrong time.
Correct. Like, I think we look at it like, well, it's got to be, you know, that's dumb to put all your nitrogen up front. Well, depending on the growing season, if the plant's readily uptaking it then and can have a drastic uptake then and it's the right time, then you did it right.
Right.
But what about guys? I've had guys I've seen even a shift to like zero up front or very little and almost all say side dressed and going like not say split apply, just.
Sure,
and that
shifting when
right, and that too, you'd think, well, it's better because it's closer to when the corn needs all this, and that shift as well wasn't always better. So, yeah, that I look at it as a we don't know when the perfect time is. So, if we do it more like two or three times, hopefully, we're in the right window there where more of it stays. The other part is so you're only doing like the less amount of times, the more you're applying at once. And that in general, too, isn't a good thing. It's better to spoon feed smaller amounts if we can.
Yeah. No, and it is a good risk mitigation of, you know, your highest risk is probably putting it all up front because you don't know what the weather's going to bring and all of a sudden get some torrential rains and nitrogen's mobile in the soil. We know this. We've talked about this. Like it flushes through the system and now you've got nothing for the rest of the season. And it might actually end up costing you more money if you go, because you'll go back and potentially apply more. So if you're looking to save money, that's probably the highest risk with, I would say, pretty close to equal reward when you look at that versus split applying. And so Iowa State kind of showed the same thing. They were looking more at soil type specific data, and it showed that a well-drained soil probably doesn't need the split as much as, say, like a poorly drained or very sandy soil that's going to have a higher leachate.
When you say well-drained, my brain went to sandy, but you don't mean that. You mean like a well-drained loam.
Yeah, Yep.
Okay.
And so UW Madison did kind of a similar look at it. So they did some research. And so on a well-drained soil, the application timing didn't really seem to show a big effect in season on poorly drained or wetter soils. Showed more of a benefit, and they did it over 3 years, and pretty much every year there was some difference between when it was applied. And then they also had an earlier study, so that was done like in the 2015 time frame. They had an earlier study from late 90s, early 2000s, where they looked at poorly drained versus well-drained soils and applications. And so split applications were advantageous. And this gets to your weather point, Todd, is where early season rainfall was above average, split applications were better. But when the rain was normal or below average, earlier applications seemed equally good or even maybe slightly better.
It's interesting that below average would do the same as normal. I would think below average you could have a yield drag because it's just not available. If it's,
you're saying the split stuff doesn't become available?
No, if you put it up front.
Like not having something there to,
yeah,
to activate it. Kind of up front. It just seems like the up front sooner or later does
that's
that.
True, Todd. Eventually, it's
where's the side dress needs.
And most up front isn't surface applied.
Correct. Right.
It's
right.
Subsurface or worked in or something. Like in a no-till situation, you might have a higher occasion of volatility, and then that would get into, do I need some sort of urease inhibitor or something to... But yeah, we can't predict the weather. So like Todd mentioned before, that's something to always be considering too. And we won't know. Even a long-term forecast isn't always very accurate, so we won't know what the weather's going to be. But there's definitely pros and cons, I think, to going both ways and just knowing your soils and doing maybe your own end study on your soil would help with that. So I had a plot this year, and I worked with a farm, and we did a zero N rate. We did their normal upfront rate. Then we did a split application of that same rate, and we did a single pass. So we reduced the nitrogen rate and did about half of what their normal rate was. Excuse me. And when we went across the board, and this was same field, predominantly the same soil type. It was all silt loam. It was mostly plain old silt loam. There was a small section in the back half that was
stuff.
A different silt loam. I don't remember.
So that'd be your medium fine textured.
Yep.
Like just a good soil.
It's a good soil, yeah. And across the board, the upfront and the split application for this year's weather, which we had a cooler, somewhat moist early part of the season. Like it wasn't as wet as it was last year, but we were getting fairly timely rains, or in some areas we're getting heavy rains. And then a fairly good growing season in general. We really didn't see much yield difference between whether it was split applied or all put up front. And even the half rate, we didn't really see. I mean, it was less, but it wasn't beating it by like 20, 30 bushel. It was a 10 bushel difference between the split up front and the half. So there was probably room to reduce the nitrogen rate a little bit, which again, if you're looking at tight margins, might be a good thing. But it also showed that at least for this year, we didn't really see a huge difference one way or the other, whether it was up front or split. So the split comes down to, is it advantageous based on soil types? And that soil type it wasn't, but other soil types it might be. So we had another one with a heavier clay soil. Another farm did a similar study, not quite exactly the same, but similar. And they saw that their split application did pretty much on par, regardless of, they had more different nitrogen rates. I think it was 25, 30, 35, and 40 units of nitrogen applied at side dress. and they saw, you know, not a huge difference, but they also saw more of a gap between the lower rate and the higher rate. So it was on that heavy soil, maybe a little bit bigger of a difference when that timing of nitrogen happened. So regardless of whether you choose to split or not, the timing factor is another thing at UW, and the stuff I found had out there was, so if you're on the sandier soil, it's probably worth splitting. There's a high probability of leaching, so you know, if you put it all up front, you have that greater risk of losing nitrogen before it's really used. If you're a fine texture and very or poorly drained soil.
So it has to be both fine texture and poorly drained.
Yep.
Okay.
There's a high probability also of early season loss. So another.
Sure, like denitrification and yep. just water sitting. And
water, yeah, taking away what you want the plants to uptake. So that probably benefits from split. Medium and fine texture and well-drained soils doesn't seem to matter as much. Just get your in and out there. And on well-drained soils that aren't sands, you have options. So you could do both to try to look at it from a standpoint of, especially if you haven't really looked at your own nitrogen use efficiency and you're thinking about reducing your nitrogen rate, you can always go back and side dress more. Like, you can put what you want down, and if opportunity presents itself, you can go back and make another application if you feel you need it or the weather holds. You can't go back. Well, I shouldn't say. You can't undo what you've applied, but you can always apply more, if that makes sense. So mm-hmm. if you're worried about that risk, it's better to maybe do a split application and get out there. The timing doesn't always work out. We know that, especially if it's a poorly drained soil. Sometimes it's harder to get back in there, especially if it gets wet. So
on your plot, what was the yield drag on the zero N?
Not actually that bad. So the zero N was about 25 bushel below the split and up front.
Is zero still getting, is there some like starter or is it a true zero?
It would have got, yeah, like a little bit of starter up front.
But it didn't. Just the caveat of like, the zero doesn't always mean zero.
Well, right. That's what I'm saying. Like, organic N too. That
yeah, well, 100%. Soil, right? It's good soil. Right. Yeah. And that would be true why those other rates you didn't see as much of a difference. Obviously, the soil itself was able to provide a lot.
Yeah. So when it comes to looking at whether you should split your N or not, you should look at soil type, how much N you're going to put out, and whether or not you think there's a risk of losing it. And also your capacity to do side dress. Are you hiring somebody to do it? Is it then going to cost you more money because you have to pay somebody to come in? Do you have your own equipment? Can you get a buggy? And while there's maybe, I don't want to say there's no too early, because obviously you can apply N too early and have it cycle through before, like if fall N, that's why we don't really do a lot unless it's, you know, manure or something we know will potentially hold. But you can put it on too late. There's been different studies where, you know, you can miss that opportunity sometimes. And early season, the plant's trying to decide how it's going to form the cobs and everything later in the season. So if you starve it up front and heavily feed it on the back end, you're still going to be limited. So
I think you bring up a good point, Matt, is that with the higher clearance sprayers and the advent of, say, Y-drop, we've kind of been able to, now we have the equipment to push it later.
Yep.
And there's, like, you've got some University of Minnesota research here that basically it says, in their experience, in-season applications after V10 have never produced higher yields and sometimes actually reduced the yields compared to earlier. So I thought that was unique. I mean, I don't always, that's a very blanket statement. I've seen, you know, Y-drop work on certain scenarios where we're trying to, certain varieties, certain scenarios where you want that kind of full season there for silage, not as much, more for grain, obviously, to try to get it to kind of finish out strong and just really split that up. But, and then I think they bring up, is their sweet spot is V4 to V8 corn is the best. And kind of they what they have here, if you get past V8 or V9, that's sort of getting actually too late.
Too late.
And I think that's unique because I got enough farmers, like, when they start, they might, and it might be V2 when they start, but usually it's V3, V4, and it feels very small corn to be going at that stage and just
sure
feels a little too early at times.
When you have so many acres, like, depending right on the number of acres you got to do, you have to start.
But
some
but I, what this would show is, yeah, don't feel bad about going at V4 corn. That's still a really good time to be going. And then their research, too, has shown 40 pounds pre-plant is enough to get it kind of started until you get to the side dress. Now, that, I think, is a big part of saying when you can wait till. It depends how much pounds you have early on. Then you know, at 40 pounds, probably closer to V4, V6, you're going to want to be going. But say you put on 60 pounds pre-plant, you could probably wait a little longer.
Yep.
And be okay to get some of that.
Provided the weather's good. Correct. And you didn't lose all it already the, and all right those things, right? If it's been great but weather and it still should be there.
The advent of more like liquid fertilizer on corn planters and it being nitrogen has helped a tremendous amount of just getting enough early season and on to get it going. It's in a good placement. It fits all the 4 hours that way. And then it really gets a good start, and then you can layer it with your side dress.
Yeah, so just some things to consider when you're thinking about how you're going to handle nitrogen for next year. And, you know, spreading out that risk isn't necessarily a bad thing. Just be mindful, and on-farm research is a great way to do it. You know, do a plot if you haven't already and look at, you know, what your nitrogen use looks like. Because every farm, depending on their soils, is potentially going to be different. The example I gave that farm showed that basically it doesn't matter if they split apply or put it up front, but you know, you get some different soils, it might make a bigger difference. So now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So Bayer has announced a Roundup alternative with the rollout of a new weed killer in Australia. So the global agrochemical company behind glyphosate has unveiled plans to produce a new class of herbicide in Australia. Bayer says the product Icofolin Methyl is the first new chemical specifically designed to kill sprouted weeds by attacking leaves to hit the market in more than 3 decades. Company has submitted applications for the product to regulators in the European Union, United States, Canada, and Brazil, and will seek Australian approval next year with a rollout expected in 2028. Farmers battling herbicide resistance welcome the move, but environmental groups are not convinced the full risk is understood. So since its introduction in Australia in 1974, glyphosate, which is the key ingredient in Roundup, has been become a critical tool in food production, but with growing resistance from both weeds and consumers, it has impacted the effectiveness, and there are not many good options to replace it. So this will be interesting to see where this leads, and obviously they're trying to get it here as well, so it'll be interesting to watch with it being first introduced in Australia how well it does, and if that means, you know, it's nice to see somebody else be the guinea pig for a little bit. So they're both glyphosate and icofolin are non-selective herbicides that kill all plants they contact, unlike selective herbicides, which spare your desired plants. So it will be similar in efficacy where it'll go after grasses and broadleaves alike. So, all right, now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. Well, next week, a lot of people will be sitting down to a Thanksgiving meal of some kind, whether it's a Friendsgiving, a family Thanksgiving, a Hungry Man, frozen Thanksgiving meal, whatever it is. Next week is Thanksgiving, and so as has been celebrated here in the United States. The holiday of Thanksgiving usually revolves around a bountiful meal that includes things like stuffing, potatoes, cranberry sauce, pumpkin pie, and above all, the turkey. So how did the turkey become the centerpiece of the feast? Well, a lot of people assume it has to do with the first Thanksgiving and the pilgrims, settlers at Plymouth Colony and their meal with the Native Americans, the Wampanoag, in late 1621. But despite the history that's been shared of that particular meal, it's not even for sure that turkey was served at that time. They know they had deer and fowl and other birds, so it could have been turkey, but it also could have been ducks, geese, anything else. There's not really references either to the pilgrims considering this meal a milestone worthy of any special commemoration. So it wasn't uncommon for them to give thanks for the harvest in general. By the 19th century, however, turkey became a popular dish for Thanksgiving-type meals. The bird was very plentiful. One expert estimated that there were at least 10 million turkeys at the time of European contact. Turkeys on family farms were almost always available for slaughter, so convenience was another part of it. Nevertheless, turkeys were not yet synonymous with Thanksgiving at that time. Some people credit Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol with bolstering the idea of turkey for a holiday meal, but a writer named Sarah Josepha Hale played an arguably more important role. In her 1827 novel, Northwood, she devoted an entire chapter to the description of a New England Thanksgiving with a roasted turkey placed at the head of the table. At about that time, she also began campaigning to establish Thanksgiving as a national holiday in the United States, which she believed would help unify the country as it teetered toward civil war. Her efforts paid off in 1863 with a proclamation by President Abraham Lincoln making Thanksgiving an American holiday. So that's where things kind of get started. So not only the fact that the first Thanksgiving potentially had turkey, but there was a campaign around the time of the Civil War for Thanksgiving not only to become a holiday, but to include turkey. So
Often you guys have turkey not on Thanksgiving. Besides turkey sandwich, like turkey, never. Like lunch meat.
Like for birthday parties and stuff, sometimes we'll
have turkey.
Do like a turkey breast, yeah, or something. Yeah,
yeah, I feel like it's a very specific meat to, yeah. That,
one turkey a year.
Yeah. One turkey a year, that's all you get.
Yep.
All right. Well, fair enough.
I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's not real often, but for our kids' birthday parties or sometimes I'll just makes a good alternative, like say you're going
to
grill up hamburgers or something, just get a turkey breast. They're not huge and they're fairly easy to cook. Just throw it in the oven. So, but yeah.
All right. Thank you, Matt. Thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. We made it even easier for you because we're now on Spotify. So on your Apple phone, your iPhone, or your Android phone, you can just download Spotify, search Tilth Talk Radio, and you'll find us there. We're also on Apple Podcasts on your iPhone. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthegg.com/podcasts. And you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now it's time for some cool beans that's corny and some current events. So cool beans.
Cool beans.
Cool beans.
Cool beans. Our cool beans this week, with Thanksgiving being next week, Thanksgiving turkey dinner costs have dipped by about 5%. Annual survey shows the traditional meal with all the fixings will require fewer dollars per person this year, but look to shell out more dollars if turkey isn't the only meat on your menu. Ooh, so
there you go.
Yep,
that's a good way to use it at other holidays. It's just the cheapest meat right now. You know, right. Everything's just crazy expensive.
So Thanksgiving dinner average cost across the last 3 years, 2023 was $61, 2024 was $58, and 2025 is about $55. Now, there are caveats to this because it does depend on the region you're in.
Or is that per how many people?
Average cost for 10 people.
10, got it. Yeah. That seemed like a really good meal.
Per person, everybody. So the turkey itself usually accounts for about 43% of the total cost, but this year A 16-pound turkey is only 39% of the cost for a 10-person meal. So it's a that's where you get the difference is the turkey itself. As you look at some of the different aspects to the meal, like your dinner rolls, vegetables, stuffing, sweet potatoes, all that kind of stuff, there's a little bit of difference. So the drop in price is the turkey, the cube stuffing, fresh cranberries and dinner rolls, five items that are often included, like sweet potatoes, frozen green peas, a vegetable tray, whole milk, and whipping cream are on the upside when it comes to price. And pumpkin pie mix and shell pie shells remain about the same as they were in the past. So not a big change there for your traditional dessert. Is that what you guys usually, big pumpkin pie?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So is pumpkin pie the only, or is that the only time you have pumpkin pie, or do you eat pumpkin pie other times?
No, that's probably the only time. Yeah. Sometimes.
It's Christmas.
Yeah. I would say Christmas, yeah. Sometimes we'll have it too. So the region you're in depends, or affects the price as well. So though for those in the West, Thanksgiving dinner is looking at about $61.75 for 10 people, so a little bit more, and the most expensive region for the U.S., 12% above the national average. If you're in the Northeast, you're also a little bit above the national average, but not quite as much, $60.82 for 10. The South is the most affordable holiday meal at $50, and Midwest is sitting right about the national average, $54.38, so it's slightly below, but pretty much right in there. So where you live may depend on what you have. And if you expand beyond just turkey, like include ham, potatoes, green beans, that would increase your cost for 10 people to $77 or another, or about $7.71 per person. So it all depends on what makes up the meal, but in general, the turkey itself is cheaper. So hopefully that means for a yummy Thanksgiving for...
Yeah, you're making me hungry for... All this talk of pie and...
Do you make the... I just saw an article yesterday about the... I think it was a... Because I know your wife is a big Friends person.
Oh, yeah. Really,
the leftover sandwich with, like, the gravy-soaked bread in the middle to keep it moist. Is that what, the, that what
leftover
you do with
turkey sandwiches are, like, the best.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're right. They're awesome. Actually, just Thanksgiving leftovers in general are still really good.
Yeah. All right. That's Corny this week. An ag economist says it will be unlikely that China will buy its 12 million tons of U.S. soybeans in 2025. So an ag economist at Ohio State University said he doesn't expect China to purchase 12 million metric tons of U.S. soybeans before the end of this year. Ian Sheldon said there isn't much incentive to make additional purchases since China already has its necessary supplies. I think a lot of it's going to be driven by what the Chinese government is doing in terms of pushing its state traders to import soybeans, he says. Going into the new year, it's going to depend on private traders and the relative price of American soybeans versus Brazilian soybeans. He said as the marketing year is winding down and importers now face shipping constraints, we'll add to that. So you can get shiploads of anywhere from 60 to 80,000 tons through the Panama Canal. And it would take 150 to 200 shiploads, depending on how large each vessel was, to go through the canal to hit that 12 million tons. Recent data released from USDA shows only two new export sales since last month's meeting in South Korea. As of Tuesday, China has purchased just over 1 million tons of U.S. soybeans in the current marketing year. So, wah-wah.
Wah-wah. That's a bummer.
It's almost just like the logistics of it, you're
right.
Saying.
Like, I mean, like what he's
is
saying
a fair
is like
statement. That's an interesting
that much to ship through the Panama Canal would be very difficult.
We can't even get it there if you want it.
And I think the canal travels probably, I don't know where it is. I know it was really backed up a few years ago. I don't remember hearing about it being backed up in more recent times. So I think even with steady traffic, that's 150 to 200 shiploads extra to go through there seems like it would be a pretty big logistical
issue. Well, and he's talking about in 2025, there's only 40 days left. And so that means,
right.
Look, think about
it's
how many ships got to go a day, right? That's
right.
Four ships a day or better.
So, all right. Now we'll wrap things up with a Feel Good Friday. Oconto tree farmer is sending a tree he watched for 15 years to Madison, so he hopes someone will get to enjoy it. Dane Vandervelden has an eye for a good tree. After all, one of his trees, a rare 20-foot balsam beech fir cross, was chosen for display in the White House Blue Room in Washington, D.C. in 2016. And in 2019, another of his trees were selected by Vice President Mike Pence to be displayed at No. 1 Observatory Circle in Washington, D.C. in 2020. And for the first time in 12 years, Vandervelden and his wife, Mary, will be honored to provide the state capitol Christmas tree here in Wisconsin, in Madison. So the award-winning trees were grown on Vandervelden's business, Whispering Pines Tree Farm. With nearly 120,000 trees, the Oconto Tree Farm was considered one of the state's biggest. Between the 200-acre tree farm and their retail lot in De Pere, Vandervelden sold around 6,000 trees last year. Or sells about 6,000 trees a year. So between the tree farm and our retail lot, we were selling a tree every 20 seconds, he said. It was just getting to be too much to handle year-round, and it was time to retire, so he sold the farm in 2019, but kept a few acres for himself and his dad on a 6-acre parcel. Vandervelden says there were a handful of trees that he deemed genetically superior, so he knew he had some nice trees there. And so that's given him the opportunity to provide the state capitol tree this year, so you get to go check it out if you take a visit down to Madison during the holiday season.
I was just at the Capitol for the visits, and it was not up yet. It's got to be cool.
No, I imagine.
You were just there Tuesday, right?
Yeah. So, no, it wasn't there. But one of the representatives I visited, her office was already, fully on decorated for Christmas. It was actually kind of great. Wow. It was really neat, actually.
Were you like, what about Thanksgiving?
No, it was cool. It made it feel like home almost, and it was cool. That's cool that to be the person to get to provide, especially to go to D.C. and, this one to go to Madison. That's really cool.
All right. Well, that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So this week we talked about split application of nitrogen and whether or not that might be the right fit for your farm. In our spotlight, we took a look at potential new glyphosate alternative that will be first introduced in Australia. Ag History Minute, we talked about the history of why we eat turkey at Thanksgiving. Cool Beans this week was the turkey dinner cost is down a little bit from last year. That's corny. It's that the economist says that it's unlikely China will buy their full 12 million metric tons of soybeans within the calendar year. And Feel Good Friday, Oconto Tree Farmer is donating the tree for the Capitol Christmas tree this year. So thanks for listening. And as always, happy farming.